and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. While the West maintains its anti-Russia rhetoric and backed up with ever more sanctions, the position of official Kyiv is not so clear. When addressing the Davos crowd, Ukraine's Zelensky called for negotiations. One of his chief negotiators refuted this. So, where does Kyiv stand? Crosstalking official Kyiv, I'm joined by my guest, Margaret Kimberly in New York. She is executive editor of Black Agenda Report. In Paris, we have Rachel Marsden. She is a political columnist, strategist, and talk show host. And in Hong Kong, we have Angelo Giuliano. He is a political and financial analyst. All right, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Let's go to our guest in Hong Kong first here. I mentioned Davos in my introduction, Zelensky talking about there has to be negotiations. Also, his chief negotiator refuted that immediately after the Ukrainian president said it. Henry Kissinger is someone I usually don't invoke in this program, but he was also at Davos. He said the conflict with Russia must end in 2 months or it will spiral out of control. So negotiate or not to negotiate. And someone that I don't have a whole lot of respect for his political history, but his intellect is something you have to deal with here. So where do we stand in all of this here? Go ahead in Hong Kong.
Well, Peter, this is all rhetoric. We should look at fact, not words here. Zelensky is clearly not willing to negotiate. And we have to actually challenge, is he really the one in power? We all know that he's pressed by neo-Nazis, and you have also Washington that have the last say. So, the power has been hijacked since 2014 in Ukraine. Ukrainians have no say. Ukraine is not a sovereign state. It's not a democracy. You have a part of the population, the Russian population, is a second-grade citizens. They've banned parties. They've banned medias. It is clearly not a democracy. So we need to challenge who is in power here. And it's probably the decisions are taken in Washington. Zelensky. He's never changed. His job is still the same. He's an actor, he's a comedian, and he has a script, and the script is written by the CIA.
Okay, well, that was pretty succinct there, and that's something I've been saying for quite a long time. Let me go to Margaret here. I mean, one of the interesting things is that we have a rift within the Western alliance with French President Macron kind of on his own, but ineffectual, I would say, largely, is that no negotiations, and the French president says, well, we should at least keep talking here. All along, events are playing out. Western media doesn't want to talk about the true state of military affairs in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. The vast majority of the Ukrainian army is in the east, and it's being absolutely crushed, though that's not being mentioned. I suppose that $40 billion grift that's been there started with Washington, they hope will change it. But this is where we stand right now. And I'm really glad that we heard this is not about democracy, because we know Lloyd Austin, the defense secretary, said the U.S. position is to weaken Russia. So the mask has come off. This is where we stand. We stand at war without anyone invoking it yet. Go ahead, Margaret.
Yes, it's you're absolutely right. Anyone who really knows what they're talking about knows that Ukraine is losing. So when we hear about this equipment that's going to be sent there, and we have to point out, a lot of this equipment takes weeks or even months to learn how to use. If the army is being destroyed, Ukraine is taking huge casualties. So it's turned into a big surprise, a cash cow for the military-industrial complex. It was never really about caring about Ukraine. The object of this war is, as the defense secretary said, to try to weaken Russia, which is not going to happen. Russia's military is stronger than Ukraine. Obviously, of course, they were going to win. All this talk of Russia being a gas station masquerading as a country and all these stupid comments obviously are untrue. They are impoverishing the entire world in a futile effort to try to weaken Russia economically. There has to be negotiations, but I worry because Biden and his team of amateurs don't have a plan B.
Let's expand upon that, Rachel, here, because What I just see here is mission creep, okay? And it's really no coincidence that the grift of Afghanistan was over last year, and now even the sums of money are getting more and more similar. There are people in Washington talking about $3 trillion. That should light should go off in your brain there. That was what the Afghan grift cost this year. I mean, it seems like there's very few winners in this at all, and mostly people on the ground all across the globe are the biggest losers. Of course, the arms manufacturers, the lobbyists, the Hunter Bidens of this world, they make money off of it. Go ahead, Rachel.
Yeah, well, I think, Peter, that maybe mission creep is the ultimate objective to this whole thing, because it seems like the objective on the part of the United States, which really has no interest in putting an end to this party, this spending party, is to divide Russia from the EU, and seems to be working, obviously. Yes. And also to prolong this conflict so that Russia is tied up and can't get involved in other activities when this is its main focus, or at least those are the optics. But I think the reality is that this is going to all be dictated by economics and largely from Europe, because Macron is already starting to make noises here in France about the fact that this can't go on forever. We saw that the Italian prime minister at the foreign ministers meeting last Friday in Turin tabled a 4-point plan for peace. Kiev doesn't seem to be too interested in it, but the fact that he even brought that up suggests that he's probably discussed it with his counterparts here in Europe, and there probably is some support for it. And the fact that he presented it officially to Antonio Guterres, who's the Secretary General of the United Nations, who's already made a trip to Moscow, suggests that maybe there's some interest in having him bring this forward and see what can be done with it. The fact that Kiev doesn't seem to be interested in it right now, it's probably largely a factor of just the reality that the United States and Europe seem to still be somewhat behind it. But as that solidarity and unity weakens, and Zelensky did touch on that point, this weakening solidarity in his speech in Davos this week, I think we could see things starting to change.
Yeah, it's interesting that you point that out. Let's go back to Hong Kong. Angelo, it's very interesting that this whole idea of solidarity. There is a level of Western solidarity, but if you look at, you know, you're in Hong Kong, by the way. I mean, this effort to isolate Russia, but if you look at it broadly, it's the Europeans and their American allies that are getting more and more isolated. People are just not on board for this, okay? Saudi Arabia came out in the last news cycle saying, we're not getting involved. We're not getting involved in this. You know, this is your fight. Okay, the Indians feel that way. Obviously, the Chinese feel that way. If the issue is to isolate, it's self-isolation. And Europeans were never supposed to be hurt by sanctions. They're being hurt more by these sanctions than Russians, at least at this point. Go ahead.
Well, what we're living here is, I think we should look more globally, this transition between from a unipolar world to a multipolar world. And I think this was those countries, they didn't improvise. The position of India probably was talked. They talked to each other. And I think this is the timing is how can I put it? I think it's a combined effort from the global south. The reaction they have is coordinated, and I think China worked also closely with Russia to prepare to what we're living here. Keep in mind that everything that we're living right now, in Ukraine and also in Taiwan, you have think tank papers. For example, the RAND Corporation, they already planned that. They talked about a window of opportunity between 2015 to 2025 where they can contain China. And part of containing China is containing Russia. So The first step is contain Russia. So you can actually, because Russia is gives a lot of oil and gas to China. And then the last goal is China. And you see, I mean, it's not a coincidence that you have Biden now that is going to South Korea and Japan to beg them to help them into containing China.
Well, I mean, let me go to Margaret. I think Biden's trip is very comical. I mean, they want to get the Chinese on board against Russia, but he's going around the Pacific Rim trying to create an alliance against China. I mean, this is a childish, a juvenile thinking here. I really don't know who's coming up with these plans here, but I mean, I don't think the Chinese watching all of this take it very seriously whatsoever. Go ahead in New York.
Well, of course they don't. No one does. I find it amusing that the U.S. can spend all these years accusing China of having concentration camps and all manner of things and trying to cause a disruption in Hong Kong, and then turn around and expect China to turn against their strategic partner. So yes, this trip is going to be a failure. None of these countries wants to be used the way Ukraine is being used.
Excellent point.
Yes, but they're trying to do that to Taiwan. It just astounds me that having had Ukraine blow up in their faces, they're now trying to replicate their failure with Taiwan. This administration is incredibly dangerous. Biden is, I did not vote for him. I never supported him, but he is 10 times worse than I thought he would be. That he has gone from creating one disaster to trying to create a new one. But I think people need to see it's the U.S. that's isolated. It's not Russia. The rest of the world is telling the U.S. no. You have little vassal states like the U.K. and other European countries. They're the only ones going along with this calamity of Washington's making.
Well, it's very interesting because very few people, particularly in Western media, would ever describe that as the case here. But, you know, you're absolutely right. In the second part of the program, I want to talk about the costs and sacrifices that have to be made for this policy and the dangers that are down the line here. I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Official Kiev. Stay with our team. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing Official Kiev. Okay, let's go back to Rachel in Paris. I used the term Official Kiev because genuflecting to our guest in Hong Kong is that because of the result of the illegal change of power in Kiev in 2014. That's why I call it Official Kiev. All right, Rachel. Russia must not be allowed to win. This is the mantra that we hear through the halls of power in the West. But they're not going to lose this, that's for sure. Why? Because it's considered existential here. And this is what the problem of Western policy is that they don't want to see Russia win, but Russia knows that it cannot lose. That is a situation that is direly dangerous. Go ahead, Rachel.
Well, I think at this point, all they're interested in doing here in the West is just tying up Russia, destroying the European economy, which obviously Europe isn't willingly going to do.
Why, Rachel? Explain. I want to know why. Why? I mean, that is a question I can't get my head around. Go ahead.
Well,
why?
Because the people who run the show in Brussels have an ideological axe to grind against Russia. And for some reason, we have this weird kind of mass hysteria, mass psychosis on the part of our leaders, where there's no courage on the part of any of them to really stand up and say, hey, look, you know what? We shouldn't be doing this. This might be America's agenda, America's fight, but it's really counterproductive for us. Instead, they all just hop aboard like we've seen them do with pretty much everything else. And who's going to be stuck with the bill? Well, the two big economic and military engines of the EU, France and Germany, and that doesn't mean the leaders, that means us. They have no problem. They get assigned cars, they get their allowances, they get these huge salaries. They don't really have to worry about much in life. Their feet don't touch the ground. They're not worrying about the price of gas. People here in the French election running for office couldn't even tell the media when asked what the latest price of a baguette was. You think these people really care about what we're dealing with on the ground as average citizens in Europe? No, all they care about is their ideological agenda, and they're really hell-bent on achieving it.
Yeah, but Rachel, isn't it quite curious that I would agree that, you know, the United States, it's rubbing its hands with glee that they, at least this point in time, they have hegemony over Europe. They, you know, they got everybody in line. They're going to get rid of Sergeant Schultz in Germany real quick. They don't like social democrats, okay? They'll get rid of him, okay, and they'll seal it, okay? But then what's it worth? What is the prize worth when its productivity will go to zero? What is the prize of Europe if it's worthless? Rachel.
Yeah. Well, all you have to know about what's going on right now is you can learn by looking back at what happened last fall when France got screwed out of a nuclear submarine deal with Australia by the United States, which jumped in and grabbed the deal from France. We're talking tens of hundreds of billions of dollars over many, many years. Huge deal for the French economy and for the French military industrial complex. And at the time, there were French generals who were telling me France should really just pull out of NATO over this. They should really take a stand because they just got screwed over by the United States and their allies. But what did Macron do? He settled for a little bit of help in the Sahel region where they're drawing down anyway because they've just been kicked out of Mali. So he essentially got left empty-handed. And what did he do? Just sat there and shrugged. So that's all you really need to know about European leadership. And how they're handling everything vis-a-vis the United States.
Well,
right now.
Angela, let me go to you in Hong Kong to continue what Rachel was saying. You know, why didn't Sergeant Schultz, that's what I call him in Germany, because that's essentially, he goes to Washington, D.C., gets insulted to his face, and he smiles. Okay, then he comes to Moscow, and he says, you know, words of genocide and ethnic cleansing in Donbass is laughable. What kind of German chancellor talks like that, given Germany's history? But anyway, so, you know, we have the French really angry about that deal. Then, you know, the Americans essentially want Germany to turn off its industry. So why don't the French and the Germans say, yeah, we're out of NATO. This is your gig. We don't want it. Rachel's right. There's no courage, no intellectual courage in the European Union. Go ahead in Hong Kong.
I think it's very important to put into the context. I mean, what is the EU? How was the EU created? You know, the EU was a U.S. initiative after World War II. Jean Monnet, who's considered to be the father of the EU, was on the payroll of the CIA. So the EU was an initiative from the U.S. to better control Europe. So you see the process. After World War II, you had a gradual loss of sovereignty and democracy because Europeans have no say. They elect some people that go to Brussels, but then we don't elect von der Leyen. She was not elected by me, as I'm Italian. I didn't elect von der Leyen. It's done behind closed doors. So it's an entity which is extremely undemocratic, which is controlled by the lobbies. They have no say. Normally, in normal times, you would have France and Germany to take the decisions when it comes to foreign policy. Here, we see clearly that the EU is taking the decisions.
Well, and let me continue with that. So we should respect the democracy in Ukraine and ignore democracy in the European Union. No, I mean, no one has ever voted for the super state that they want to create. They will never put it up for a vote because it won't pass, okay? And when they have referenda that don't pass, they have another one until they finally get what they want. That's their diminished understanding of democracy. Margaret, we're rapidly running out of time. You know, one of the things that's happening, and maybe this is exactly what these elites want, they want a complete breach breaking Russia away from Europe. Well, that's in the cards, and irrespective of how this military operation in Ukraine is settled, there is a breach here. There will be a new Cold War for generations with an S here. Well, Russia's got other things to do. The world doesn't just stop for the West, okay? Go ahead.
No, it doesn't. And, you know, that's part of the danger of the United States. We have these people who are simply delusional. They think that, and I'm sure the sanctions have harmed Russia, but it's not what they think is going to happen. The value of the ruble is going up. They have increased pain all over the world, rising fuel prices, rising food prices, food shortages throughout the global South, nations who can least afford to go through this, and for what? for a vain dream that they can weaken Russia or break up Russia or contain Russia, or their big fantasy is to get another Yeltsin in power so they can pick Russia's resources apart at will, none of which is going to happen. And there has to be someone in this world who is thinking clearly, who knows this is all a really dangerous fantasy, and that will stop this destruction that the U.S. and its vassals in Europe are behind. And yes, this break is irreparable, but Russia is prepared now to turn its back on Europe, and we'll see how well the U.S. takes care of Europeans, even those that do whatever it wants it to do.
You know, Rachel, we've been the food shortages have been brought up here. This is a very real thing. So I suppose it's a rhetorical question on my part. So to weaken, break up Russia, it's worth seeing the world starve. Is this the level of cynicism?
Well, we've seen what's happened in war zones where the United States has intervened. We saw what happened when they pulled out of Afghanistan in a big rush, mm-hmm. and what's happened there since. We saw the state in which they left Iraq and other countries in Latin America. I don't think that's really a big consideration in the hierarchy of priorities for the United States.
Yeah, but Rachel, I thought it was the rules-based order and the West is morally superior to everyone, you know, and they invoke, well, they do it sporadically, international law. I mean, it's really quite amazing. Let's go to Hong Kong here. It's really quite amazing to me that they put on these airs all the time, but it only when it serves their political, economic, and financial interests. All the rest doesn't really matter. Rachel brought up great examples of Western virtue in the world. Go ahead.
Well, I think the virtue should be about tangible results. The West, they sell you the idea. You know, it's just a fake democracy. Democracy should be, the legitimacy should come from the satisfaction of people. I've lived in China 27 years. I talk to Chinese, they're happy with the system. It doesn't need to please me, it needs to please them. 95%, according to Howard University study, 95% of people are happy with the CPC. Why? Because it's delivering. It's delivering. You know, people are looking for tangible results. In the West, it's promises. It's about showmanship. It's about the politician that is going to make the promise I'm expecting and is never going to deliver it. And this is what we're living, the fake democracy of the West. And in Asia, they're not naive. They don't want that system because it doesn't deliver.
You know, Margaret, I'm glad that we this is what we heard from Angela here. I mean, the way I look at it very broadly is this is the failure and the end of neoliberalism. And this is kind of a last gasp here. It's really, when we look at this gambit with Ukraine, which is all intentional, this could have easily been avoided. And we're talking about containing China. This is their last throw of the dice here, because a multipolar world is here. And it's something these people cannot accept. Go ahead, Margaret.
No, they cannot accept it. And I just wanted to add about this. They love to use the word democracy, even as they undermine the people at every stage. You know, here in the U.S., Biden has broken every campaign promise, every single one. They are so cynical. They know what people want, and that's why they make the promise. But when they get into office, there's always a dog and pony show and a good cop, bad cop to explain away their failures. But it is a unipolar world. There is no turning back. But I, again, have to say, I fear that these people who are running U.S. foreign policy don't know that. They don't have a plan B. This is their roll of the dice to try to keep the game going. But the only way to keep it going is to do something dangerous. We need people who have common sense, who can say that we must have peaceful coexistence with other countries. This notion of controlling the whole world will doom us all to failure at the very least, and war at the worst.
Yeah, we don't deserve these elites, that's for sure. All right, that's all the time we have here. Many thanks to my guests in New York, Paris, and in Hong Kong. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, crosstalk rules.